I suppose it's a sign you're getting old when someone starts to run through dates and things like that, and I'm hoping that they're right because the numbers are so high that I can't keep up anymore. In Shakespeare's play, Richard II, a character says, "Must I not serve a long apprenticehood to foreign passages, and in the end, boast of nothing else but that I was a journeyman to grief?" I'll read that again. It's kind of early for Shakespeare. "Must I not serve a long apprenticehood to foreign passages, and in the end, boast of nothing else but that I was a journeyman to grief?" In other words, after traveling about and doing the bidding of his master, this speaker worries that he won't have anything to show for it except the grief of lost time, lost effort, and no payoff for his efforts. At the end of an apprenticeship, the end of a period of close working relationship between student and teacher, the apprentice should have learned from the teacher, the master craftsman. Deep and thorough learning, and ideally the perfecting of a skill, should have taken place. Coaches and athletes, and I would say professors and students too, engage in a similar period of teaching and learning. A college athlete comes to a team for about 4 years, sometimes five, is taught and led by a coach, and during that time, deep and thorough learning, and ideally the perfecting of a skill, should take place. This is a weighty charge laid upon the coach, and one that coaches should take very seriously, and I think most do. You've probably seen some of those memes online that juxtapose two pictures that are radically different from each other in order to make a self-effacing joke. For example, on the left will be a picture of an Olympic runner in full stride, ahead of the pack, Usain Bolt, someone like that, with the phrase under it, "What I think I look like when I'm running." And then on the right side will be a picture of an overweight, middle-aged, 1980s tracksuit wearing kind of slob, looking like death as he's coming into the finish, and the phrase under it will be, you know, "What I really look like when I'm running." Well, teaching and coaching can be like that. I'm a bit of a hopeless romantic, so I can easily fall into the trap of idealizing what something can be like. There's a song in the old Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, The King and I, that for some reason exists in my mind as an ideal of a teacher-student experience. It's the song "Getting to Know You." I'm not going to sing it. It's a very ancient saying, but a true and honest thought, that if you become a teacher, by your pupils you'll be taught. As a teacher I've been learning, you'll forgive me if I boast, and now I've become an expert on the subject I like most, getting to know you. Getting to know you, getting to know all about you, getting to like you, getting to hope you like me. Getting to know you, putting it my way but nicely, you're precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy when I'm with you, getting to know what to say. Haven't you noticed? Suddenly I'm bright and breezy because of all the beautiful and new things I'm learning about you day by day. I don't know when I first heard this or when it imprinted itself on my mind as the way classroom instruction happens. I don't really see myself as Julie Andrews kind of flitting about the classroom while all the students kind of smile and hang on my every word and like sing along, you know, when the chorus rolls around. But that one stanza, I really like: getting to know you, getting to feel free and easy when I'm with you, getting to know what to say. Well, that stanza, believe it or not, this is kind of sad, right? That's kind of a goal of mine when it comes to teaching and when it comes to coaching. Feeling free and easy and knowing what to say can only happen if the teacher and student, athlete and coach, have a strong relationship, one in which both parties are participating and engaged, a relationship in which, you know, you could break out in song and no one stares at you like you're crazy. So while somewhere in my mind, I think that that song is the way my time with students and athletes ought to be, the other side of the meme is unfortunately, you know, more accurate sometimes. Students staring at their phone, you know, as I drone on and on, trying to stress certain words and phrases to try to, like, get their attention in the classroom, only for them to, like, glance at the clock and start packing up their backpack. Or athletes, you know, just not doing things just the way I want them to. You know, not really warming up or stretching right or being on time. Or not running the pace that I want them to run. Coaches are all control freaks, just so you know. We really, really want our athletes to do everything just the way we think it ought to be done. And, you know, meanwhile, I was never half the runner that, you know, all of my guys are. You know, I want to give them a real whopper, you know, of a win one for the Gipper kind of halftime speech. But we don't have halftime in cross country or track. And even if we did, I'd probably stumble over my words and like tell them to run the wrong way or something like that. So it's probably better off. I'm exaggerating a bit, of course. But there is an ideal there that's based on relationships that I really do want. And I desire it because I believe that through relationships, we can reach our athletes and students in the meaningful way that most coaches and teachers really do want to. Mentoring a group of people, a team, as coaches do, is tough. We have over 40 athletes on the track and cross-country roster, and each one of them is unique. Everyone needs to know that they're necessary, that their role and their contribution is uniquely theirs, that they aren't easily replaced. The challenge for a coach is to make sure everyone internalizes that truth. And then the challenge is identifying each person's talents and gifts and then providing each some opportunities to use those gifts. What I don't want is for my coaching to be a stumbling block, a heavy yoke to bear for our athletes. I don't want their time on the team, as it would be stated in Richard II, to be a long apprenticehood that leads to nothing else but grief. You know, is having me as a cross-country coach a cross, you know, that my athletes must bear? Or am I an inspiration to them? Do they reach greater athletic achievements because of me or in despite of my coaching efforts? And when they think of me 25 years from now, am I just a fuzzy memory, someone to whom they were in close proximity to for a brief span of time, but who really didn't leave any lasting impression? Am I someone they want to forget because perhaps I let them down or disappointed them or said something in frustration that left a memory of painful emotions? Obviously, I hope not. I hope that if and when they think of their old coach from college, that they can trace the line of influence that I had that led not only to greater athletic achievement, but to greater maturity and greater faith. I hope that they can say that I helped them grow into the men and women, the husbands and wives and fathers and mothers that they become. I hope that once in a while, just once in a while, you know, they say something like, well, you know what coach would have said about that, or you know what coach would do, or something like that, just so I'm still there, right? I think that's what all coaches and teachers and parents want, to instill behavior and instill thought that outlives our time together, to instill values that outlive us, basically to be mentors. So there's that word, mentor. It's in the title of this session, the influence of an intentional mentor. Well, if I'm going to be intentional about being a mentor, I suppose I should get straight what I think a mentor is. The word mentor comes from Homer's ancient Greek epic, the Odyssey. So we're about to get real boring and teacher-like here. So in the Odyssey, if you think all the way back to high school or in one of those painful World Lit 1 classes that someone around here teaches, in the Odyssey, the main character, Odysseus, has been away from home fighting in the Trojan War and trying to make the long voyage back home after the war for many, many years. His son, Telemachus, has grown up essentially without a father. A mentor is the name of an old trusted friend of Odysseus. And the goddess Athena, because she's trying to help out Odysseus and his family, at several points in the story disguises herself as mentor and appears to Telemachus in order to teach him about the values held by Odysseus and about how to become a man and about how to react to the threat posed by the many rivals of Odysseus who are, you know, conspiring and positioning themselves to take over the long-absent Odysseus's kingdom and his wife. According to Harvard Classics professor Gregory Nagy, in Homer's Greek, a mentor is someone who gives mental strength to someone else. I like that. Gives mental strength to someone else. The Oxford English Dictionary tells us, however, that the term mentor did not come into common usage until the 1700s. Shakespeare, for instance, writing around the year 1600, he never uses it at all in any of his plays. But in 1699, a French writer named Fenelon wrote The Adventure of Telemachus, about Telemachus. And it was a very, very popular work, and it drew attention to the character mentor's name as one which means a guide or an advisor or a trusted counselor. Fenelon's work was translated sometime around the middle of the 1700s into English, and the term mentor very quickly became recognized as meaning what we think of today when we speak of a mentor. The word itself is used often enough in the world of sports. For instance, Caleb Joseph, catcher for the Baltimore Orioles, during a very recent press interview, said the following about mentoring young players. He said, "I feel it is heavier than even producing on the field, if that makes sense. It's a huge responsibility and a huge honor." And Bryce Harper of the Washington Nationals, when he was new in the major leagues, was mentored by Jason Wirth, very deliberately. He is like an older brother to me, Harper states. I think having him here and having him teaching me things every day has been pretty incredible. Cam Newton of the Carolina Panthers has talked numerous times about how Warren Moon, the retired quarterback, has mentored him. Likewise, Mike Trout of the California Angels gives a lot of his credit for his success in baseball to Torrey Hunter, who mentored Trout when he first made it to the majors. It's there, and people are deliberate about it in the world of sports. Well, in addition to getting to know you from the King and I have another image in my mind of a professor whom I take as a role model. He's a fictional character in a novel. And this figure has held this place in my mind since long before I ever considered becoming an English major or a professor. Here's how he's described in the novel. He is a seemingly arbitrary man. This is because he knows what he is talking about better than anyone else. He is a philosopher and a metaphysician, and one of the most advanced scientists of the day. And he has, I believe, an absolutely open mind. This with an iron nerve, a temper of the ice brook, an indomitable resolution, self-command, and toleration exalted from virtues to blessings, and the kindliest and truest heart that beats. These form his equipment for the noble work that he is doing for mankind, work both in theory and practice, for his views are as wide as his all-embracing sympathy. This description of this professor is given in the novel by one of the professor's former students, who calls upon his old mentor when he is out of ideas and out of options, and his former professor drops everything and immediately comes to his aid. I'd love to be described that way someday by a former student or a former athlete recollecting what I was like as a mentor. So the professor I'm describing here that I've aspired to be like since before I was ever going to be a professor is Abraham Van Helsing from Bram Stoker's Dracula. I read it when I was a senior in high school, and lots of images and scenes from it made a strong impression on me, including the character of Van Helsing. Van Helsing's former student, now a doctor in his own right, cannot diagnose what is ailing a young woman, so he contacts Van Helsing, because if anyone would be able to diagnose it, he's the guy. And sure enough, Van Helsing figures out that it's a vampire bite. In the novel, Van Helsing continues to lead the small band against Dracula and some other vampires, and he acts as the protector of the female protagonist after she comes under the spell of Dracula. Listen, though, to the descriptive words used here. Iron nerve. Indomitable resolution. Knows what he's talking about. Professors certainly fall into that category. At least what they want to. Self-command. Kindliest and truest heart. Noble work. Open mind. Toleration. All-embracing sympathy. Along with his eagerness to help out a former student, these are qualities any mentor should strive to embody. Importantly, we will see shades of some of these characteristics again in a few minutes when we get into some passages from the Bible. I promise we'll do that. This is a lectureship, after all. If in my role as a coach I am a mentor, then I need to determine what I'm mentoring my athletes to become. How should my influence over them change them? I mean, we're generally getting some pretty good students here at Freed. We really are. The vast majority of the athletes that have been on the cross country, now the track team too, are the kinds of kids about whom I don't have to worry on road trips. Their parents and youth ministers and teachers and whoever else, they've all done a pretty good job so far training up the child in the way he ought to go. Well, I'm the track and cross country coach, right? So I guess I want them to be successful cross country or track and field athletes. But how to measure success? That's not an easy question to answer. But here's mine. I want to help them learn how to give full effort, how to dedicate themselves, be resilient, stay focused and on task, not just in one race or workout, but over the course of a season, a year, a college athletic career. I want the participation on our team to prepare them for those times later in life when staying tough and committing to work towards something is more important, more high stakes than a mere race. I'm talking about staying committed to a spouse, actively and purposefully raising children, seeing loved ones through life's tragedies, putting in the hours of thankless service and leadership at church, enduring the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. The preparation and determination, the ability to lead and encourage teammates, the ability to stay cool and perform at top notch when under pressure and nervous, to trust their own hard work and preparation, to keep pushing even when it hurts and everything in you is telling you to quit. These qualities are what being on the team can help them learn. When things aren't going right at the halfway point of a cross-country race, when a thrower is scratched a couple times in a row, and when those athletes can, in those moments, breathe deep and collect themselves and respond to the situation with courage and confidence and rationality and faith, then their experience on the team has been worthwhile. Later in life, they can respond to setbacks in the same way, I hope. If learning to be that kind of tough also comes with all conference honors or other accolades, then that's great, and we'll celebrate those, certainly. But those are a distant second in importance. I don't think that it's a sign that I don't have a competitive edge, that I think that's a distant second. I do, and I like to win, but I try to keep in mind what the real competition is. In Ephesians 6:12, Paul tells us who the competition is. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. I want to win some track and cross-country titles. And winning in the athletic realm is not incompatible at all with living a Christian life. But once my athletes and I are long dead and gone, whatever's in some trophy case isn't going to be too relevant when the role is called up yonder. Thus, as a mentor, sport is ultimately useful as a means to strengthen the faith of my athletes. Sport is not the end in and of itself. If you've attended this Influence of an Intentional Mentor series this week, then you've heard Coach Elliott and Coach Estes here offer some very motivational and thought-provoking ideas about mentoring. Now, they've discussed examples of mentoring relationships in the Bible. Jethro and Moses, Moses and Aaron, Moses and Joshua, Elijah and Elisha, Paul and Timothy, and others. In these relationships, we see an older individual taking someone younger under his wing and teaching and training him until the student is ready to strike out on his own to do God's will for him. A hang-up that I think a lot of us have with trying to mimic figures from the Bible is that, obviously, except for Jesus, they're all so very flawed. Yes, I'd love to mentor future leaders like Moses does, but Moses himself is disallowed from entering the Promised Land. I'd love to teach and inspire a nation the way that Ezra and Nehemiah do for the Israelites once they've returned to Jerusalem from Babylon. But Ezra forces Israelites to have married non-Jews or just Jews that hadn't been taken into exile to divorce, regardless of the fact that God doesn't favor that divorce. And both Ezra and Nehemiah, by the end of their stories, have been largely ineffective at altering the behavior of the Jews, with Nehemiah raging about the country, beating up and tearing out people's hair who fail to follow God's law. And Paul has a long history of persecuting Christians before he becomes one himself, to the point that early Christians, justifiably, are very skeptical about his conversion. All were teachers and mentors, but all were rather wretched in some ways. But that, of course, is the point. God can perfect us through Christ. Now, that God will use us, even in all of our inadequacies and idiocies, to further his purposes. Now, God is the hero of that story, not us, not any single human. There's a parallel here to see how we see ourselves as mentors, models, examples. I know how deeply flawed I am. If we're honest with ourselves, then we all know we are sorry creatures of secret sin and pride and fear. And Romans 3:10 tells us straight up, none is righteous, no, not one. The very natural question to ask then is, how in the world am I the right person to act as an example to others, especially to college students, my athletes, who are coming into their own as independent adults? But revealing our shortcomings and owning up to our mistakes is part of the mentoring process. To understand and display to our students that we are prone to mistakes and prone to sin, but that God nevertheless forgives us and takes us as one of his own, is a powerful message for them to learn. Plus, the young people in our lives will soon enough see through any efforts to hide our mistakes and imperfections. Some of us are even blessed so mightily by God with so many imperfections that the very idea of hiding them from the world is just so absurd that we may as well own up to them and not even try to hide them. That kind of vulnerability, letting your athletes see that you make boneheaded decisions once in a while, can be scary. I'd much rather be perfect, or at least have people think that I am. But that level of vulnerability, in actuality, can improve the physical performance of the athlete. In a 2013 study of Christian values in the world of elite sports, primarily rowing, Jane Lee Sinden found that pressure to, in essence, be a perfect machine-like athlete who never reveals any weaknesses to a coach or teammate leads to anxiety that negatively impacts athletic performance and leads to serious injuries due to an unwillingness to reveal any out-of-the-ordinary muscle or joint pain. Conversely, in this study, athletes who could be open with a coach about personal and physical mistakes, worries, or failures perform better in practice and in competition. Sinden concludes that coaches who work to open lines of communication and who encourage their rowers to express their feelings are not normalizing the athlete's emotions in a negative and destructive manner, but are contributing to the maintenance of good health and improved sport performance among their rowers. Similarly, in a 2006 article, Adam H. Naylor writes, "Even in the high-pressure world of intercollegiate athletics, successful collegiate coaches are found to make a significant amount of decisions by considering both the athlete's long-term athletic and personal development. Even in this era of high-profile collegiate athletic competition, it is reasonable to expect a coach's game-time decisions to be evenly balanced between development and a win-oriented mentality." Naylor continues, "Pressures to win are great, yet it is important to remember that the college athlete is an unfinished product with much need of nurturing and opportunity to fulfill athletic potential." So personal needs are as important as game time decisions during the game. Side note, this article came out in 2006. Naylor uses as an example of a coach who does all of this correctly, the former Penn State football coach Joe Paterno. This article was published about 5 years before the Jerry Sandusky crisis, crime, whatever became known. So I'm curious to know who Naylor would use nowadays if he had to rewrite this. So make of Naylor's examples what you will. I like what he has to say, even with Paterno in there. Both Sinden and Naylor in their studies determined that a team atmosphere that allows for openness on the part of both athlete and coach regarding the expression of worry, of injury, of everyday trials, leads to a healthier emotional state and better academic performance, as well as greater athletic achievement, which certainly sound like the goals a mentoring coach would have for his or her athletes. The Apostle Paul, in his second letter to the church at Corinth, discusses the idea of being open and honest about human weaknesses and limitations. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, 24 to 30, and chapter 12, 7 to 10, he writes, "Five times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one. Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I was adrift at sea. On frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, and toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, and hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure." Sounds like athletes complaining about a practice on a cold day. "And apart from other things, there is the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak, and I am not weak? Who is made to fall, and I am not indignant? If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness." And Paul continues this thought a few verses later. "So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from being conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong.'" So to return to our point about mimicking examples of biblical mentors, deeply flawed as they may be, if we want our athletes and students to see in us God's grace and forgiveness at work, then those whom we mentor need to see or know of our failures and shortcomings, just like Paul. And we know that in this, we are not reveling or celebrating in our sinful nature. In Romans 6, 1-2, Paul tells us, "What shall we say then? Are we to continue to sin that grace may abound? By no means. How can we who died to sin still live in it?" Instead, Paul in Corinthians explains that we allow God to be glorified through our reliance upon him to overcome our sinful natures. If Paul, for the sake of Christ, is content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities, then I suppose I ought to be content with these things too. If it's good enough for Paul, it's probably good enough for me. I think the opposite situation is true too. Our athletes need to see us in our moments of successes, our moments when, with God's strength, our faith and courage shine as beacons for lost souls to see. And some of us, in what I say is true humility and a desire to remain free from pride and boastfulness, shy away from letting others see those moments. It's like how Dr. Vyers, our VP of academics, is always telling the faculty that even though it's an instinct of Christians to refrain from tooting their own horn, when they publish a scholarly article, the university really, really wants and needs to toot that horn for the purpose of establishing our academic credentials and drawing prospective students to Freed. So in the same way, it's good for those who are mentoring under us to see us when we do as God would have us do. But if we take Paul's willingness for his weaknesses to be part of his examples to others, it could change the way we react to his repeated calls to the recipients of his letters to follow his example. They are to mimic not only what we see as his dedication to spreading the good news and his bravery in the face of torture and imprisonment, but also his utter reliance upon God because he is absolutely hopeless without God. In Philippians 3:17, Paul writes, "Brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us." He's inviting his readers to imitate him. "Brothers, join in imitating me." 1 Thessalonians 1, verses 5 to 7. "You know what kind of men we proved to be among you for your sake. And you became imitators of us and of the Lord, for you received the word in much affliction with the joy of the Holy Spirit, so that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia." 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 6 to 9. "Now we command you, brothers, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep away from any brother who is walking in idleness and not in accord with the tradition that you received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to imitate us, because we were not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it, but with toil and labor we worked night and day that we might not be a burden to any of you. It was not because we did not have that right, but to give you and ourselves an example to imitate." In these passages, Paul invites his readers to imitate his actions and words. One impression that we always get from Paul is that he did not hesitate to roll up his sleeves and do what needed to be done. "But with toil and labor we worked night and day," he says. As far as the trait of a mentoring coach goes, this corresponds closely to the findings of Peter Scales in his 2016 study of relationships between coaches and athletes. Scales writes, "A study of high school basketball players also found they preferred playing for servant leader coaches who emphasized caring for and developing them as people beyond the sport, building a sense of community and belonging, empathy, trust, inclusion, humility, and doing things for others. The players of these coaches were more intrinsically motivated, more confident, better able to deal with challenges, concentrated better, and handled pressure better than players who had autocratic coaches." The novel Dracula, as well as the athletic team study by Peter Scales and some of these others, are not overtly Christian. However, when principles of teaching, coaching, and mentoring are used that read as if they came right out of the writings of Paul, then the mentor is able to positively influence the mentee. For my childhood or college years, I sat through far more sermons, pep talks from coaches, and class lectures that I have forgotten than those that I still remember. There are some. What the adults in our young lives say certainly matters. It gives us instruction, information, things to think about, things to challenge our thinking, ideas to wrestle with. But I've forgotten more than I remember. Far more for me are memories of the person, what they were like, the things they did, how they said things, rather than what in particular they said. I remember conversations and moments of different types of interaction or activity. I remember not only the tone and emotion in their voice as we interacted, but I remember observing them, seeing them in action with other people and in different types of situations. With teachers and coaches, I remember how they communicated, and quite often how communicates as much as their actual words. Gentleness and kind words, a soft tone, a little smile that tells you the mistakes are all right, these convey as much, if not more, than the explanation or instructions from a coach or a teacher about how it should have been done and how it should be done the next time. If my kid is going to grow up to imitate one of his coaches, I'd much rather he have coaches who don't flip out and embarrass everyone involved with the team. I want him to imitate coaches who imitate Christ. That's a theme that runs throughout the New Testament, Jesus telling us to imitate him. In John 13, 34 to 35, Jesus says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And in the next chapter, John 14, verse 12, he says, "Likewise, "Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do." We'll imitate him if we love him. More and more examples, mentoring through modeling, start to jump out at us from the scriptures once we're looking for them. And more these biblical examples correspond to modern scholarly studies of athletics. In Matthew, in his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus admonishes his hearers to be examples. Matthew 5:16, "In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." He's telling us to be examples. And in Matthew 7:18-20, "A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, you will recognize them by their fruits." Paul writes to Titus in Titus 2:7-8, "Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say against us." And in 1 Peter 5:3, in Peter's instructions to the elders on how to care for those they shepherd, "They are to care for them without domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock." In the language of the Bible, we're seeing the same language that we use when we talk about mentors and academic works. Compare these passages to the conclusions drawn by those academics. Veronica Hanke writes that studies suggest that the most memorable coaches, those who athletes attest have had a significant impact on their lives, were the ones who modeled exceptional character both on and off the playing field. It is not enough to help an athlete improve her skills. An exceptional coach exemplifies integrity, empathy, and fair play through her actions at all times. And Carl Lindholm concludes, "Coaches then are teachers, and they succeed to the degree to which they understand that their job is the selfless task of educating students and not the selfish glory of a single-minded pursuit of glittering records." The same characteristics that over and over again in Scripture we are encouraged to embody for the benefit of non-believers and less mature Christians are the same characteristics that athletes respond to when embodied by a coach. That's an important point. The same characteristics that over and over again in Scripture we are encouraged to embody for the benefit of non-believers and less mature Christians, scientific studies are showing us, are the same characteristics that athletes respond to when embodied by a coach. At our team Christmas party back in December, Coach Menino had the very good idea to give a survey to our athletes about coaches as mentors. We tried to write the questions in such a way that they wouldn't just be writing about us, since that could be kind of awkward. So their answers were pretty much about coaches they've had in the past. And of course, a few just flat out said that they were writing about us anyway, and then proceeded to write some very kind words. I've read their responses several times. I really like them. It's eye-opening. And the response of our athletes, their responses jive with what these academic articles are claiming. Here's a sampling of their responses when asked, "What do coaches do or say that prevent them from being good role models?" So what do coaches do or say that prevent them from being good role models? When coaches blow up on the team without giving encouraging words go a long way. And about five other people said something that mentioned encouraging words or building them up. When they do what they tell their athletes not to do, be hypocritical or condescending. 8 people had something about that. Stress achievement over health of the athlete. 6 people had that one. And these weren't multiple choice. When I say they had that one, they all pretty much were putting very similar phrases. They were probably all sitting next to each other and cheating. Being unapproachable. Multiple people talked about that. If they care more about winning than pushing their athletes to just do their best. Yelling at their athletes. No one likes that. Apparently no one in the world likes that. Like 15 people don't like being yelled at. Using bad language. Yelling profanity. 8 people don't care for that. Belittle you. Put the sport above moral values. Do not demonstrate a Christ-like attitude when angry. And show favoritism. And all these, I'm including the ones that, 4, 5, 6 or more people all wrote about. When asked about qualities that make a good coach or a good mentor, here's what they said. I had to whittle some of these down. Some are kind of long. So I tried to categorize them all. A good listener, good communicator, helpful, approachable, knows what to say, makes everybody feel like they are a somebody, makes everyone feel important, tough but fair, pushed me to do my best, and these likewise. I mean, there's like 10 people, 7 people, 8 people, you know, saying more or less the same thing for all these different categories. Funny. I'm assuming that means laughing with us and not at us. Encouraging, positivity, never gave up on me, believed in me. Calm, kind, caring, understanding, patient. 17 people mentioned being patient. Do the little things. Go the extra mile. Leadership. Honest, moral, Christian, trustworthy, humble. These are all phrases and words that our athletes used. Cares about their athletes as people. Concerned with mental well-being. Well, let's look at Paul's requirements for elders and deacons. They're found in 1 Timothy 3, 1-13, and then in Titus 1, 5-9. From 1 Timothy. The saying is trustworthy. If anyone aspires to the office of overseer, he desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, sober-minded, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace, into the snare of the devil. Deacons, likewise, must be dignified, not double-tongued, not addicted to much wine, not greedy for dishonest gain. They must hold the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. And let them also be tested first, then let them serve as deacons if they prove themselves blameless. Their wives, likewise, must be dignified, not slanderous, but sober-minded, faithful in all things. Let deacons each be the husband of one wife, managing their children and their own households well. For those who serve well as deacons gain a good standing for themselves and also great confidence in the faith that is in Christ Jesus. And then further qualifications for elders in Titus. This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife, and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination, for an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered or a drunkard or violent or greedy for gain, but hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. He must hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to rebuke those who contradict it. I don't know if our athletes simply have read Titus and Timothy a whole lot, but what they're listing as qualities of good coaches and good mentors sounds like they're listing the qualities for elders and deacons. Obviously, elders and deacons, it's a little bit more expansive, talking about how you run your household. But a lot of these same qualities athletes are responding to. It's what they thought of, right? They didn't know they were going to take the serving. It's what they thought of, these same kinds of qualities. So Paul here in these passages about elders and deacons, now he seems to prioritize being a model over any skill set or knowledge expertise. Now, to be sure, being able to teach, holding firm to the trustworthy word, and being able to teach in sound doctrine are all there. So knowing the word of God is necessary, certainly. However, the majority of qualifications here are what we might call today in the business college, you know, biblical soft skills. They're personal traits and attributes, effective communication skills, and a good disposition that would allow you to succeed in the business world of the New Testament. For those of us who have been believers for a long time, none of these traits or practices, whether from scripture, literature, academic studies, or our survey of our team, sound earth-shattering. Humility, self-command, service to others, integrity, sympathy, dignity. These are riffs on the fruits of the Spirit and the Beatitudes that we've heard so often in Bible studies and sermons. But if you've been around sports much, especially youth sports, and certainly youth sports that have some church-going families involved, then you know that we need to carefully and deliberately assess just how well we are mentoring our kids as they participate in sports. As parents watch and yell at games, as youth sports coaches instruct their athletes, as parents and coaches interact with referees and umpires, we would do well to remember Paul's words to Titus regarding using sound speech that cannot be condemned. Or the charge of Jesus to love one another, just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. I fear that we, and I'm a coach saying this, I fear that we too easily make allowances for falling far short of these commands when sports are involved. We lose sight of what really matters, which isn't wins and losses, And it isn't our efforts through the volume we use to yell at a coach, or worse, at a kid on the opposing team. It's not that volume we use to turn little 10-year-old Johnny into a national full scholarship top recruit baller. I'm rather sure that Christ would say that when the referee misses a call, or when the big kid on the other team has got to be a few years older than all the kids are supposed to be, that we should let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven, instead of some of the things we are more likely to say. We know this in theory, and we know this sitting here now, with no ball game, no race going on. But do we know it when we're there in the gym with all the other screaming parents and fans and brothers and sisters, and the excitement and the tension of the game that's unfolding right in front of us? I hope we do. As a coach, I hope I do. Being hospitable, being dignified, being self-controlled, being sober-minded are all traits we must work on. But we would learn what they are primarily through observing others who have those traits. In essence, we could mimic a mentor who exhibits those traits. And that is why I think mentoring through modeling needs to be an effort that we deliberately make. As we've seen so often, we are told by the writers of the Bible to be examples, to be models. Thus, being models of faith and love should not be left to happenstance. We're commanded to do it. Fortunately, we have plenty of biblical examples to follow. And I bet it wouldn't take long for each person here to identify some wise, mature Christians that would act as mentors to us, showing us in turn how to mentor others. Moreover, even without any kind of formal training, each one of us would also be able to pretty easily identify someone younger who could use a friend and a good conversation about whatever is going on in their lives. Just listening and caring could begin a relationship with someone to whom you would be a mentor. I'm constantly surprised by some of the rough situations that some of our athletes find themselves in, sometimes through their own mistakes and sometimes through no fault of their own. I'm not a trained counselor at all, and my wife could take the mic here and probably verify in great detail that I'm really not good at saying the right thing. I'm really good at saying the wrong thing sometimes. But what I have done plenty of times is to sit and listen to one of my athletes as they get some things off their chests. I don't think there are many magic spells I could utter to make it all better. But just the time together with some of them has turned over the course of the semester after semester into a relationship between mentor and mentee, a coach and an athlete. If a relationship like that can even just nudge some of them closer and closer to God, or perhaps just get them to come down off the ledge that they're on and breathe deeply, then it's worth it. If Paul can become all things to all people to do that same thing, then we can also live our lives as models of Christian faith for those around us to see and be encouraged by, and hopefully be mentored by. Thank you for your time.